Welcome to the Harrington Star FinTech Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Discussions. I want to showcase people across our industry who are advocates for change. I love to celebrate the wins, but we know there is so much more to be done to ensure that change actually happens to build a truly inclusive industry. In these Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Discussions, I have a number of series. The Humans of FinTech, The Talent Surgery, The Maternity and Paternity Stories, and the longest running of all, the Women of FinTech podcast series. I do lots of work to drive change campaigns across our industry to increase inclusion within the workplace. So please contact me to see how we can partner together. You can contact me through LinkedIn or on my email, nadia.edwards-dashti@harringtonstar.com. In the meantime, enjoy the show. Welcome to the Women of FinTech podcast series. We are here today to celebrate the wins, raise awareness of the challenges, and walk the talk for change across the entire industry. Today, we are joined by Emmanuelle Mathy, the Co-Chief Risk Officer for Wealth Management and Group Head of Credit Risk at Schroders. Schroders is a global investment manager, helping institutions, intermediaries, and individuals across the planet meet their goals, fulfill their ambitions, and prepare for the future. Emmanuelle is another woman in our industry who became a C-level player and did not start in STEM. She went to law school, worked for JP Morgan for 10 years, covering credit risk for the investment bank, then moved to Schroders. So today she's here to share her story and all the lessons and learns along the way. So welcome. I'm really happy to have you here with us.
Hey, good afternoon, Nadia. I'm very, very honoured to be here and very happy to be able to be on this podcast with you.
Thank you. So tell us a bit more about your role at Schroders and what that entails.
Of course. So as you mentioned, I have a dual hat. So I am both the co-CRO for wealth management, and that's really looking at credit market and liquidity risk for our private banks. We have four around the world, and that is mainly lending to individuals for mortgages or on against portfolios. So kind of traditional lending and traditional credit role. And then my other hat is I'm the group head of credit risk for Schroders, and Schroders is mostly an asset management group. So that entails some slightly less standard credit work, including, for example, agency credit, which is looking after our clients insofar as I basically help decide which counterparties we should use. And that's not Schroders money at risk, it's our clients. But of course, our duty to our clients is to pick the best possible counterparties when we trade on their behalf, for example. So that's one of my big role, as well as looking after procurement, the treasury, so our kind of balance sheet, and so on and so forth, from a credit point of view, which is, in case, you know, listeners aren't familiar, it's basically your risk that a counterparty defaults, and as in doesn't pay you back, and trying to mitigate that risk.
Amazing. And look, when I did the intro, I said, you know, I'm on this mission because I want to show people that you don't need to have been in a STEM degree to be uber successful in this industry. But the way that I introduced you, there's so much more to that story. So I'd love to hear your career journey from your perspective. And it's always great to hear some of the lessons along the way.
Absolutely. So yes, as you said, so I first went to law school. Actually, before that, I actually wanted to be in the army since I was a very, very, very little girl. But I had late onset myopia, and so I basically needed too much correction and wouldn't have qualified for any of the what I would call interesting job in the army. So I had to find kind of a last minute change when I was in my late teens. And so I ended up going to law school because why not? It seemed like an interesting topic. I really enjoyed it. Like, I loved learning about all these things. Ended up doing something completely niche, which was I wrote a paper on the law of the sea, and then I ended up specializing in international public law, which is what the UN does and stuff like, you know, water rights, and so country level things. Fascinating, but somehow didn't actually want to work in it. So that's, you know, left me a bit thinking, okay, what next? And I just looked for graduate programs in the UK because I heard they were really good, and I wanted to, you know, discover a new country. And I just ended up at JP that way. So it's not like I can pretend that finance was my dream. It's it sounded interesting, and I applied in 2007. So risk seemed like a logical place to go, because if you remember, it was just as the crisis was brewing. And so every other article about finance was, are risk misunderstood? What are the risks? You know, do people know what they're doing? And so I wanted to kind of be at the heart of the action, which, you know, might seem funny because, of course, risk is a second line function. It's not really, you know, it's not the front line, but actually when things go bad, it's where the action is. So, yeah, and little did I know, I started on the 1st of September 2008. So that was fun as the financial world imploded. But yeah, so I really, really liked that. Loved my time at JP. Did 10 years there covering a variety of things in credit for the investment bank. And then was kind of headhunted to go to Schroders and be their global head of credit, which is where I am now.
Well, that is such a great story and really interesting to hear that you were there right at the thick of it when we went through the crash of 2008. You know, like, it's great that you were in that risk position to see exactly, you know, why it happened, how to prevent it from happening again. Like, it's really fascinating. And great work from JP, because I think especially back then, there were lots of banks who didn't have grad programs that looked at people from different backgrounds. And look at what a great decision that was. And I'm constantly encouraging people, like, open up your choices for people. Like, if you want diversity of thought, let's open it up and let people join. And I know that that's really a big passion of yours as well. You know, you believe in the fact that people in finance and tech can come from all sorts of backgrounds. So I wanted just to hear your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. But first, I realized I forgot to answer part of your question. You asked about my lessons along the way. And actually, I thought it was an important one. So I'll come back to your question. But first, I'll mention, because there are a few things I picked up. And I think one was, like, to believe in yourself. I think some people are natural at it, but actually a lot of people have to work on that. So, you know, one of the reason I liked moving to Schroders is because I was always kind of left at JP with that feeling, you know, am I really good or have I been lucky? Or, you know, are they all a bit confused and they think I'm really good, but actually, you know, maybe I've just fooled them into thinking that. And I think a lot of people have that feeling. And then, you know, moved at Schroders and I think, you know, I'm also doing quite well and people enjoy working with me and stuff. And then you're like, no, actually, wait, I am good. And so I think it's this kind of just believe in yourself and we could all do a bit more of that. And I think a corollary of that is make your strengths work for you. I think we spend a lot of time thinking about our weaknesses, what we should do differently, you know, where we're not good, where we could progress. But actually in practice, we should spend more time thinking about what we're good at and just making it work for us as much as we can. Because sometimes doing that helps you actually progress in some of the stuff that maybe you're not as strong in. But, you know, ultimately, the point of all of this, and we're about to go into a diversity question, right? The point of this is diversity wins. And, you know, if you want diverse people, you also need to accept that they will behave in a variety of ways and then they're not all going to fit in the mold. And so I think, you know, it's all just focus on our strengths and deliver as best as we can thanks to that.
And that's really, really insightful. And I love what you've just said there. If you want diverse people, you need to accept they're going to behave in a different ways. It's so, so true. But, you know, it's almost like people want their new joiners, want their team to fit into a mold, you know, but like most of the time, apart from when we're talking about differences of opinion, you know, and that's just not how it works. We're talking about people and their lives and how they think and how they process things. So that's really great to hear those lessons. And you know what? Today, I probably need to hear that as well. So thank you very much for sharing that with me. So on to the question about finance and tech and people coming from all sorts of backgrounds.
Yeah, so I think this is really key for me because, of course, if you want, you know, diversity, it's not just a, you know, oh, we have female and male and people from minority backgrounds. And it's not just that, it's also diversity of thoughts. And so you want people from a diversity of backgrounds as well, and a diversity of educational backgrounds. So they have a different way to think about things. If you've gone through an archaeology degree or a history degree or a math degree, you're going to attack things differently, but you know, none of the approach are wrong. They're just actually often complementary. And so I think for me, it's very key, be it in finance or in tech. Yes, some pockets of it are highly technical and do require skills that not everybody will have. That's fair. But actually, the large majority of it can completely be picked up by anyone who's kind of smart, driven, and willing to learn. And I think, you know, when you and I were talking last time, I mentioned that I think we like to pretend it's rocket science because it makes us look good, right? It's like if you work in finance and you say that finance is super complex, then it makes you sound like you're, you know, super smart or something. But in practice, it's not true. Pretty much anyone who's willing to work hard and put their mind to it can do well. And so I really want to encourage people to apply to those roles. And of course, on the other end, companies need to open their mind and not be like, oh, it's not a finance degree, I'm not interested. Or it's a tier two university or whatever else, because then you end up with a more diverse set of people. And I think we both agree, and a lot of other people agree, that that results in better teams and just better outcome for the entire company. But so people need to apply, like they need to not, don't self-censor. Don't assume you can't do something because you probably can do it.
Really nice message. Don't self-censor. I completely agree with that, because I think actually if I look back over the years, I've heard so many stories where people have self-censored. So it's actually work from both sides, isn't it? It's work from the companies to really open that up and to be very vocal about who they're taking on and why. But then, you know, to instill the confidence in those people. But also it's you as a person, don't self-censor. I think that's a great message. Now, that is massively linked to the next question around, you know, you in the past have seen like tunnel vision in meetings, as have I, and you were saying some very, very interesting things around that. So I'd love to hear more.
Yes, I think it's why diversity is so good for companies, is because when you don't have diversity, what you end up having is groupthink, tunnel vision, whatever you want to call it, right? Everybody ends up thinking about the same thing in the same way and ending up in kind of with the same decision process. And I think we discussed that example, but I remember reading about this program where they were like a company was trying to help some kids in needs, and they developed like a super interesting curriculum for them to do at home. And it was all based on the fact that, you know, you'd use your iPad to do stuff. And then there was a person on that team who happened to be a woman, who happened to not be white, who happened to not be from a posh background, and who happened to mention, these kids are not going to have iPads, FYI. We should probably plan for that. And then they were like, oh, yeah, okay, fair. And so they just hadn't even thought about it. The rest of the ideas was great. It just was based on the fact that they assumed everybody, of course, would have, you know, iPads or the equivalent. And so that's kind of what I mean with tunnel vision, is that you need someone in the room who's just going to be thinking about, well, that's not how it works for these people, or that's not how it works in that part of the world, or that's not how it works in that industry. And so to achieve that, you really need to focus on not having everybody who's gone to the same finance program at the same university, because they'll do certain things super well, don't get me wrong, but they'll just completely miss the rest.
And the rest of what other people would see is just so obvious. Like, I think that to me is always the point. You know, if there's anything that you need to complete, let's say it takes 150 steps. Some people will be so good at 25 of those steps. But then what about the others? So I think your example there is just so, so interesting, because like all it takes is for someone just to go, wait, hold on a minute. And everyone goes, oh yeah, we did miss that, didn't we? So that's so, so useful. My next question is around the word inclusion and authentic inclusion and what we're doing for inclusion. Can you tell me what inclusion actually means to you?
Yeah, so I think this links so nicely with the previous question, because of course you're really good at this, so you know all of this naturally flows. And so, you know, we're talking here mostly, so far we've been talking about diversity, so having diverse point of views, diverse people, and so on and so forth. But actually, diversity is completely pointless if you don't have the other bit, which is inclusion. And you know, I think in recent years, people were really focused on the D and not so much the I, which is why it was D&I, and now it is trying to change to I and D, so to really put that emphasis on inclusion. And I think a great example is, okay, in the previous question around tunnel vision in meetings, one thing I was going to mention is introverts, right? You want a diversity of personality, you want diversity of people, so you're likely to have introverts on your teams. They're less likely to speak up in meetings, right? So how do you ensure that this really highly valuable, super smart, keen person that you hired, who happens to be an introvert, also has their voice heard, right? If you don't do that, and that's the inclusion point, then there's no point in hiring them. I mean, not no point, but because they can contribute other ways, but your duty not just as manager, really as a person in that meeting, is to, you know, make sure that you're like, hey, X person, what's your view on this? Or I noticed that you're trying to speak earlier, or what did you want to say? Or you didn't seem to agree. What? So it's reading body language, it's creating a space that people feel safe. And so I like to do that with juniors, for example, right? It's like, your job is to disagree with me. Like, please, like, that's where you're here, is because you're like, you know, you have different views, different ideas. And if you never disagree with me, you're not doing your job well. And so it's creating this kind of space where people feel like they're valued, it's safe, they're trusted. And so I think that's what inclusion means to me. It's not just having diverse people, is letting them be different, right? So not expecting them all to fit through the mold, not just expecting them to agree with you. And I'm not saying it's easy, right? Sometimes it annoys me when people disagree with me if I think my idea is great, and then we have a good idea, right? And sometimes, you know, I'll kind of end up on the winning side of the argument, and really often actually I realize, well, no, because I'm quite senior and I don't do the day-to-day, I might have a question, like an idea that sounds absolutely fantastic, but doesn't work in practice because, you know, it sounded good from, you know, the top, but actually doesn't, you know, work for people on the ground doing the day job. But if no one's willing to put their hands up, then you end up spending 6 months developing something that will never work.
Mm. Really, really insightful. And I think what I love about this answer is that you've given like genuine examples of how you've encouraged people to just give you that feedback, give you that honesty of opinion, but also make them understand that this is like your expectation of them. Because I think it's so easy for people when we're talking about inclusion to say it's about diversity of thought, get everyone saying it. But in reality, how many meetings have we all been in where you're sitting there and you know that everyone's head down, being quiet, they're not going to put their hand up and tell the boss that they think he or she is wrong, you know? And that's because we haven't set the environment up correctly. Whereas what you've just said there, it's about setting it up and setting it up right and encouraging people. But I love your honesty that sometimes it can annoy you. It's like, no, I want my idea to go through. So I think it's a brilliant way that you've explained it. And it takes me on to my last question, which is, I love to ask people about calls to action, because I think this podcast series, I always introduce it as, we're here to walk the talk. I love it when people listen to this and then they contact you afterwards, or they contact me afterwards, and they say, hey, I implemented that you advised. So I want to ask you, what's your call to action with regards to what more we should be doing for workplace inclusion?
So such a good question, and one that, you know, I spend a bit of time thinking about, because of course I want to try and influence it at Schroders. And I think what I've kind of been focusing on are probably three different things. One is better training for managers. And I really mean manager in the loosest possible sense of the word, not someone who has a direct report, anyone who's in charge of actually allocating work, giving feedback, reviewing work. So that's really in practice pretty much everybody. And so, you know, everybody needs to know what being a manager is. I think we are often accidental managers. So someone is in a role and then tomorrow they've been told, hey, we've reorganized, you have a direct report, good luck. And it's a bit like, okay, so what does that mean? And so some firms do it well, but my worry with a lot of the training around managers is a lot of it is pull rather than push. So it does basically mean that people walk in to be better managers, seek great training and become better managers, and the rest don't do it. And so they just remain not so great managers. So I think companies need to do a better job at, you know, unconscious bias, how to be inclusive, and all these things. So that'd be my first thing, is to really think about this and treat being a manager as something that is key to someone's success and to their career, not just as something they do because they have to. So that's one. The second one is we need more outspoken allies, and that's true in everything. So I think people need to take ownership of all of these issues, and it doesn't matter if you are, you know, if you're a guy or a girl or in between, or if you're gay or straight, or if you're black or white, like, it shouldn't matter. You can always be an ally to someone else, because, you know, you need to listen, you need to speak up. And so we need more and more people to do that. And we also need to be more welcoming of that. So, you know, so I'm gay, for example, and the gay community is not always super good at encouraging allies, because if people say the wrong thing, and, or, you know, they're trying to be supportive, but they use the wrong terminology, then we like jump at them. It's like, well, no, like they're trying to help. Let's be kind to each other. You know, if someone's trying to help, let's just welcome that help so that more and more people do it. And I think that will help with inclusion, because of course, if you hear someone say something that is anti whatever and you speak up, then the person that was offended by this will feel supported and included. And so on and so forth. So that would be my second one. And the last one, I think, is kind of more accountability. And that goes probably hand in hand with the first one. I think, you know, firms and managers need to be accountable for how they deal with diversity and inclusion, not just tick the box. And I think this is already happening. I think employees are, to a large extent, holding their employers more and more accountable. And people don't want to go and work for companies that are seen as being very bad in that space, especially younger generations are very focused on this sort of thing. So I think that's good. We just need more of it.
Completely agree with everything that you said there. And I've just been writing furious notes, like getting it all down, because I just think these three things are so important. Training for managers, but actually there's so many people that are managers that don't have the manager title. And therefore they are people that can influence, and they can influence in a negative way as well as a positive way. And that's so, so important that you brought that up. Mm-hmm. And I love this concept of accidental managers, because don't we see that all the time? We see it all the time. So that's really, really useful to hear. I love what you said about the outspoken allies. I couldn't agree with that more. And I'm doing lots of work to try and take all the onus off the minority in the room. And if everyone could see me, which you can't, I'm doing those quotations, because there's always going to be, in any perspective, there's always going to be a minority in the room. And I think it's very difficult when all the pressure is on that person to stand up for whatever community that they may represent for that moment. And that's not right. We are all part of each other's communities when it comes to inclusion. So I love your call to action on that. And you're so right. We are seeing it more and more, that the employees are holding their employers more accountable, and let that continue. So really, really great calls to action. And what a brilliant podcast. I feel like you've shared such like personal stories that have left us with really, really great takeaways, calls to action. And I encourage everybody listening, if you want to get in touch, please get in touch with Emmanuel, because I know that you're really open and a big fan of mentoring and supporting people through their careers. It's been brilliant to hear about your journey and into credit risk and how far you've come and exactly how you started. So it's been such a pleasure to get to know you better today. And thank you for being you on the Women of FinTech podcast series.
Thank you for having me. And yes, do reach out if you want to. I'm here to help.
Thank you.